which if you ever want just brutal honesty about where you are in this world, just talk to a seventh or eighth grader.
I have two in my house.
Yeah, I'm sure there's
routine,
no short
routine honesty.
Your ego is kept in check at that point. But one thing we always talk about in that class, and the kids are great, and they say, you know, like, how do I do it, right? I'm sitting here, I'm 12 years old, I want to own my own business, I want to do my own thing. And I just tell them all the time, I'm like, you know, I couldn't tell you how I got here, right? Like, there's no line to follow in terms of, and I think historically we grow up in cultures where we believe that there is a checklist of actual things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, you gotta do that. And sometimes that works out, right? That line takes you there. And I think the theme of what we talked about today is more, you know, identify how you want to live your life, right? How you want to live personally and professionally, you know, focusing on humanity, focusing on, you know, doing things in the right way, surrounding yourself with good people, admitting your own ignorance at all turns. I think we do that probably better than anything else that we do. And then just kind of keep yourself open to cool stuff. I mean, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew when an opportunity presented itself to me that I said, you know, this is some cool stuff. Like, I'm going to do this, and I don't know where it's going to take me, but I want to do this. And I've just taken that approach, you know, throughout. And I think a bit of that is my own ability to stomach risk, but in other ways, it's just, you know, matching up what makes you professionally and personally satisfied, and those two things don't have to be separate. And so creating that path for yourself or for a company or for anyone else is just really important to kind of raise that up a little bit and just understand, you know, how what does my existence want to be? And now once you define that, the other stuff is pretty easy.
Welcome to CT Strategies Unpacked, a podcast that explores insider perspectives of global trade, customs, and border management. In this leadership series, we talk to current and former trade professionals to get a layer deeper than regulation and enforcement. In today's segment, Eric Moncayo and CT Strategies CEO and co-founder Andrew Farrelly dive into the atypical story behind the business. Andrew shares his approach to business, how it has shaped the development of unique business opportunities, and the outlook for the future of CT Strategies. Recorded live on December 18th, 2021, this is the third podcast in the CTS Meet the Team series.
So welcome to episode 3 of CTS Unpacked. Today we have a special guest, Andrew Farrelly. Andrew and I have known each other for a really long time, but for those of us that have not had the pleasure of meeting Andrew in person, Andrew, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And thanks for letting me crash your party here, guys. It's so far I've noticed a lot of good work being done. Not a lot to tell. I'm the CEO of the company now, for whatever that means. It means I have a lot of people that I have to be responsible for. I grew up, I was born in Washington, D.C., actually. My mom was in the Army. So I was born at the medical center here, which has now been torn down, but I live very close to it. So I always drive my wife past and say, like, there should be a little plaque, you know, near Walter Reed where I was born. But then I really grew up most of my time in New Jersey, and then a little bit of time in Pennsylvania as well. I kind of moved back and forth. My whole family was mostly in New Jersey, and then my folks moved us up to Pennsylvania. Like every other kid in New York and New Jersey in the 90s, there was just, you know, the cost of living was too much for our folks. And so right across the river in beautiful Poconos, it was a nice place to grow up, although I don't think I appreciated it too much until I go back there and wanted a more relaxed lifestyle. But after that, I went to college down here in D.C. at American University, got my degree in history and public communication. So I had two types of classes. I had deep dives and give me a one pager. So that was an interesting dynamic. Came out of that, I worked on Capitol Hill for a little while. And then went and lived in Spain. I was living in Sevilla, just on a whim to see how long I could last there. Turns out I could last 6 months before I started law school up at Seton Hall. in Newark, New Jersey, left law school, realizing I really didn't want to be an attorney. I did the traditional route where you do the summer associateship and all that. And I think my interests were more on the policy side. In fact, in the international trade space, I did a lot of independent studies and worked with a lot of professors on international trade, anti-dumping, countervailing duties, dispute resolution discussions around trade agreements that were bubbling up at the time. And at that point, was CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. So I did some work on that. Ironically enough, years later, now my wife was a negotiator for CAFTA on behalf of the Costa Rican government. So you never know when something like that is going to help you, not only in your personal life or professional life, but in your personal life. So I came into CBP in 2006. I came in because of, once I realized I didn't want to be an attorney at a law school, I was like, well, what do you do? Like, when you're in law school, like the whole purpose of going there is to be an attorney. And so there's like this underground club of people that, you know, you kind of like realize, oh, they did it. How did they do it? And one of the people was one of my professors that I worked for. She was a tax professor, but she studied kind of tax policy at a high level. She had worked on the finance committee and just started setting me up with people that I knew here in DC. I also leveraged some of my own contacts, and I was up in Newark. I was driving down here every 2 weeks. I was crashing on my brother's couch and, you know, just meeting with whoever would talk to me about whatever. And one of those people that I actually met with was the Deputy Assistant Commissioner of Congressional Affairs in CBP, Seth Statler. And Seth was a friend of a friend of mine, and a great guy for everyone that knows him, and very willing to meet with me. And he says, well, you know, based on your interest, you should come and meet with the assistant commissioner, who at the time was Thad Bingle. And the small world story of Thad was about a year and a half prior to me getting this meeting with him. He and I actually met over the phone. I was doing a research project on federal tax systems, comparing the EU and the US. And he worked for the Judiciary Committee, and he worked for a representative from Wisconsin who was instrumental in certain provisions that were different than the way the EU was doing. And I won't get into the boring nature of what those were, but I needed some clarity on some of that stuff. And I just remember Thad, who is one of the nicest guys, you know, you ever want to meet. I just remember I randomly called the committee and I said, hey, I just need to talk to somebody. And I think he was staff director at the time. So he spent about 2 hours on the phone with me. Not only was I a nobody, I was a stranger. There was no reason to talk to me. And he did. And I come into this meeting and I tell him this story. And to his credit, he actually remembered. And we had a good laugh about that. And so that set a good tone. And then in addition to the fact that he was shocked and amazed that I was interested in some of the more arcane trade issues, and he says, well, we don't have anyone that's working on that, so come on in and do that. So he was very interested in me working in congressional affairs, but like everybody knows, when you get a job with the federal government, you got to go through the process and, you know, do the USA jobs, you know, that whole obstacle course that's involved there. And so I did it, and I got through to the point where I had a conditional offer based on pending a background investigation. So I was perfectly fine. I was living in Brooklyn, New York at the time, and my ex-wife at the time and I were living in Brooklyn. She had a job in the city, and CBP tells me, you got about a year and a half before we can bring you in because the background just takes that long. It's like, that's fine. I'll get a job in the city. I actually applied and I was a temp attorney for a little bit. And so I was getting ready to live that. And literally 3 days later, I get another call saying, can you show up on Monday to work? And so now I'm in a situation where I was not, you know, I didn't come from money. I didn't have money at the time. And so I'm like, well, how am I going to do this? And my ex-wife couldn't leave her job. So I called up my brother, who is here in Crystal City, living with two guys that he graduated college with. And I said, hey, man, I hate to be a burden to you. And your older brother shouldn't be a burden to you. But I said, hey, can I just come and crash for a little bit until I figure out what's going on? So he's like, yeah, of course. And the two guys still are good friends of mine to this day. They're like, yeah, no problem. I arrive at their place, and the plan was it was a 3-bedroom apartment, nice size, you know, right by the metro, you know, the bars and restaurants around. So it was a good area. And my plan was, I'll just sleep on my brother's floor, at least for a little while, and figure it out. Well, they were not using a walk-in closet in their hallway. And I was like, I think this could work. So I took the air mattress that I had brought down. It was like a queen size or something. And I stuck it in the walk-in closet uninflated, and then just inflated it until it kind of hit the sides of the walk-in closet. And I ran a extension cord from out in the hallway underneath the door, and I had a fan in there. So the extension cord hit the fan and my phone, and I had my clothes like hanging above my head. I slept with my head underneath, and I did that for 6 months. And I was going back to Brooklyn every weekend. I would leave on a Friday night.
Did you take the train up there or drive up there?
No, I drove. It was a lot of me time on the road, and I would usually leave around 6 or so, and just traffic was always awful. And that route, you know, leaving DC and then on the turnpike and, you know, getting into the city, you know, I was getting in 11, 12 o'clock every Friday night, and then I would turn around and do it, come back the other way on Sunday. So I did that for 6 months until I, you know, was able to get things together and figure it out. But that was my start in CBP. You know, I always tell people, you know, you got to really want it, and you know, things happen for a reason. So don't
and
be
so afraid. when you got this abrupt call to start on Monday, was it to Congressional Affairs?
It was, yeah. So I started in Congressional, and yeah, did that for a while. And the funny thing was, I was hired, as I was mentioning, to do a lot of the trade policy work. But at that point, the concept and the push for the legislation, which ultimately became law, for 100% scanning was moving through. And so the 100% scanning was, you know, the requirement for other countries to scan using both radiation detection and X-ray of all maritime containers at the time coming to the U.S. And you can imagine that was wildly unpopular internationally. It was used as a political football. It still is, you know, to this day. And so I showed up day one, and I never worked on the stuff I thought I was coming in to work on. So I jumped right into that world, and that allowed me to really start working with OFO, Office of Field Operations, right away. And I was attached at the hip to the CSI program, so much so that when I was doing a lot of work with them, I ended up taking a trip with them to Singapore, and Singapore was really worried about what 100% was doing. And I was told I was on this trip just as a backbencher to, you know, fill in the gaps of interest. And the Minister of Transportation was like, all I want to talk about for the next 2 days is this 100% law. And after those 2 days of doing that, the gentleman who's really one of the people that's responsible for putting me on the path that I'm at, Todd Horton, was a special agent from ICE. He was detailed over to CBP in the CSI program. And he's like, why don't you just come and work for me? And I was like, travel around the world with all my friends. And I couldn't say no to that. So
right.
Almost, I mean, within months, I was still in Congressional. Like, I always tell people I was like moonlighting in CSI while I was doing my day job in Congressional. And then it just became official after, you know, a few months after that. So, and then that started, I worked in CSI, which was, you know, so divisive and so unpopular, including within our own agency. You know, there were a lot of people that were against the concept of the 100% scanning mandate, and even doing what we were doing in the CSI program with deploying some of the equipment overseas. And that put me in front of Jay Ahern, who was the Assistant Commissioner of Field Operations at the time, and just one of the smartest people I've ever worked for, certainly one of the toughest people. And that combination made for some interesting briefings. So I actually thought when I was in the room briefing him on those kinds of things, I thought I was not a favored human being. So I would walk out with intelligent scars and feeling like my brain worked out. And then when he became deputy commissioner, and Thad, coming back around to Thad was the chief of staff at this point for Ralph Basham. And Ahern, I guess, said to Thad, you know, call Andrew and tell him, you know, I want him to come work in the front office, which was awesome. And I remember getting that call from Thad, and I was like, hey, let me think about it. And he's like, yeah, sure. You know, Thad being the nice guy that he is. And Todd Owen was the XD for cargo and conveyance security at the time. I remember he brings me into the office the next day. He goes, I don't know what you're thinking about. You're going. Like, this is not a call you get.
Yeah, exactly.
About it. And so I was like, oh, so the word is out. And so with you know, within a day, I was up working for him. And then I did that until he retired. And then I had, through that opportunity, I had gotten to know Troy Miller, who was at the time when Mr. Ahern was leaving, was at that point the director of the NTC passenger. He asked me to come be his deputy in that operation, which was another awesome experience. Went from there to Mr. Winkowski. I got to know Mr. Winkowski through my time with Mr. Ahern. We all got collectively beat up together, which was nice, and it breeds camaraderie. And then mm-hmm. he brought me in as his chief of staff for for OFO, and then I went back to the NTC with Troy when he became the executive director over both passenger and cargo, and we were kind of, you know, figuring out what that whole operation would look like now that the NTCs were coming back together. And then a little while after that, Mr. Winkowski brought me back to the front office. And after working for Jay Ahern, and then on my breaks going to a 24/7 counterterrorism operation at the NTC, and in between those, working in front offices for Tom Winkowski, after years of doing that, I kind of said, I think I need something different. And so coming back to that again, I just reached out to him and I said, hey, kind of what's out there? And that's the origin story for CT Strategies, because that call led to a conversation with him, who had left CBP at the time and had started Command Consulting Group with Mr. Basham himself, another former CBP Chief of Staff, Steve Akis, and former Deputy Chief of Staff at the White House, Joe Hagan, all nice guys and good people, and they were doing some good work. But what they were doing was very centered on, they had expertise in all aspects of CBP, but they, just by the nature of the projects they were getting, they were working a lot on the physical security and a lot of what the Border Patrol mission was about at the time. And they needed to augment their, not just customs present, but really OFO work. And so they approached me, and I remember he said, well, if you're interested, and I had turned him down for a job actually 2 years prior to this. So I wasn't coming like back to that job. I just asked him, you know, what's out there. And he said, if you're interested, how about coming and starting a company around targeting, you know, to do some, you know, domestic consulting, international consulting. And so I thought that was an interesting idea. And I, at that time, I was allowed to think about it. And so I went back. And at the time, I really got to know Al Gina. At that point, he was in his role as Assistant Commissioner for International Trade. And he and I would have lunch all the time. We would actually go to the Commerce Department cafeteria for everyone who knows that. It's, you know, in the basements and the bowels to get to it, you got to kind of walk through the underground tunnels between the Reagan Building and the Commerce Department. And the great thing about that cafeteria is BlackBerries didn't work. So we had no reception. So at least ignorance was bliss for a little while. We'd go grab a sandwich and sit and talk. And so on one of these days, Al and I were over there, and I'm telling him this story, and he just starts laughing. And I'm like, what are you laughing at? And he says, well, Mr. Basham approached me and said, do you want to start a company around trade, you know, and leveraging his role that he was in at the time? And we just started laughing. I'm like, oh, let's just do this together and see what we can do. And so us two idiots decided to start a company. And when I tell you, we had no idea what it meant to start it. I could not even begin to describe the amount of ignorance that we had in how a business operated, you know, what it meant to be a subsidiary company, what it meant you know, to manage your cash flow, all that stuff. I mean, you don't have to do that in government, right? Like in government, you get a budget every year, right? You don't even have to do that good of a job, right? Like the key in government, the key in government for getting budget for the next year is spending all the money you were given, right? And so you—
Making sure you don't give any back.
Exactly. And so the concept of managing a cash flow that goes up and down throughout the year, you know, it, all joking aside, I mean, one of the most difficult things in the government is to make sure you don't spend all your money too quickly, but that you spend it all by the end of the year, right? That's the art and the science of it. In the private sector, what you learn really quickly is that's not an effective way to learn how to manage money. You've got money that goes in and out of a company in very irregular ways, and you have to learn how to have a consistent management of your cash flow, of your revenue, in order to survive. So we didn't have any idea of any of that, and you know, it was helpful to start as a subsidiary to Command, because they at least had, you know, some experience in that and some infrastructure put into place, and so we were able to leverage a lot of that. And then, you know, we started CT as you know, the subsidiary to Command. We were focusing on, you know, CT stands for Customs and Trade Strategies. And so that's where our world kind of grew out of our collective experience in border management and everything around, you know, what to do, both from a security side to a facilitation side at ports of entry. And so we grew the business from there. And you know, a couple years after that, we weren't as dumb as we thought we were, and we had some successful years, and we were able to buy our independence and moved out of our parents' basement, as we said, or my brother's closet, I guess I should use that analogy, and are now in our own office space. We've been here for a few years now, and we're like full grown adults. We're still fairly ignorant. I'd just say we're just not as ignorant as we used to be. So yeah, that's a long answer to the question, tell me about yourself, but that brings us to where we are now.
You know what? I think that's you covered a lot of ground there. And I mean, I could go off into like 12 different tangents of just some of the things we talked about already. But I do think that I'm seeing like a recurring theme where you're embracing that unknown and you're kind of diving head first, face first into it. And I think that kind of separates a lot of folks. I'll speak for myself that don't necessarily want to be entrepreneurs because of the fear of the unknown. But I think if you just kind of look back at your personal and your work history, there seems to be a kind of recurring theme of you kind of diving into that, you know, that abyss and taking some chances. Yeah. But which I think is a good segue into my next question. So you break away from CBP and you take your partner in crime with you, Algina. And you guys start this little boutique business of CT Strategies. So now that you've broken away and you're fully independent, what separates CT Strategies from any other firm that's out there? Why do folks need to, should they come to you? You know, what is a niche that you guys are filling that was vacant that you guys realized after you got up and running?
Yeah, so no, it's a good question. And going back to your lead up to that question, I appreciate the recognition of my lack of risk aversion. And I think if you talk to my COO, my wife, and people around me, I think they'd more than agree with you. And you know, after a few beers, I'd tell you some more stories that really highlight that. But
One thing that I've learned in all these leadership schools, you mentioned American University. I went to American University for my leadership school, and one of the things that I learned going through all those schools is you need the ingredients there. You need someone he's got to be the pie in the sky visionary. Yeah. Because if you don't have that guy on the team, then you never know what you're going to be capable of. But you also need the guy or the girl that's going to bring it to, you know, to make sure the bottom line is met. Because if that's not met, then there's no electricity to see what's out there.
No,
I'll let you get back to your point. But I do think it's important to have that team built like that.
That's so spot on. And that actually does get to the heart of your question. And I'll start with saying, you know, our COO, Zach Hartnett, he is the person that keeps me grounded. And I joke on every single call. He's probably tired of hearing me say it, but he is the adult supervision in this company. It's certainly not me. It's certainly not Al. But it's fun to work with that. And that kind of goes to your question of what separates us. I mean, the separation that we see. So first of all, when we decided to set this up, it was not necessarily a recognized niche market that was absent in the consulting world. We certainly were not smart enough to identify that, but it turns out to be true that there isn't as many consulting firms out there that do focus on that border management mission. And I'm speaking from a DC perspective. That gets less true as you go around the world. So we kind of fell into that market, and you know, one thing that you realize pretty early on is business development strategies have to center around that differentiator, right? Like, what makes you, why should I go with you versus someone else? And whether or not we knew this was a successful strategy or not, and whether it continues to be borne out, the differentiator for us really has nothing to do with subject matter expertise. And I'm talking about Zach, I'm sure he'll kill me for saying this out loud, but you know, there are a lot of places with a lot of really smart people that can help you with a challenge. I think the difference in CT is Al and I truly focus first on relationships and people. And it is more important to us to have a good human interaction with our clients to truly understand the product or service that they're bringing, but also who they are. And that's also true of the affiliates we work with. We want first and foremost to build a place where both clients and affiliates who are, you know, like yourself, folks who retire and want a place to do good work, where they can come and they feel like, you know what, I want to do good work. I want to support the mission of my former agency, but I want to have fun doing it, and I want to work with good people. And that is the ethos of this company. And so we spend a lot of time cultivating that and making sure that you know, we invest in that. And there's a human and an altruistic aspect to that, no doubt. I mean, we do like that. I personally, and I'll speak for Al, I know he gains satisfaction from being able to do that. But there's also, now after doing it for over 8 years, there's a business reason behind it, because in consulting, it's not like we have a product. We're not a widget company. We don't sell sneakers. We don't sell machines or anything. The only product we have is our people,
right?
Our reputation, our subject matter expertise. And so the investment in people, in the human capital that we have, is critically important. And so that's really where we spend a lot of time. And I'll give Amma a lot of credit on this podcast. She came in as an intern. And one of the things I loved about Amma as an intern is she was never afraid to speak her mind. And so here at CT Strategies, like, an idea can come from anywhere. And so I love it when people come with ideas. And one of the things she talked to us about was rebranding, because our brand, and we're going through it now. So our new website is continually being worked on, which is the kind of the epicenter of right. our piece. But it is focused on who we are as people and how we interact. Whereas before, it was all about, you know, our expertise. Let me find a way to shove as much expertise in the marketing material as possible, which is good. It resonates with clients, but I think for us, you know, that differentiator is the investment in people, both from a real practical capital perspective and also a personal interaction. So that gives me unbelievable amount of joy to be able to come to work every day and know that that's my primary mission. And then it's not too bad doing the cool stuff we do, you know, afterwards. And so you combine those two, and it's really magic here.
Yeah, and you know what? And I'm not trying to toot your horn, but you know, just speaking from a personal standpoint, there, if you look at that website and if you look at the list of affiliates, you know, the ones that I've known for many, many years. I've known you for many years, and the consistent theme across all those folks that I know that have gravitated to CT Strategies is, you know, they believe in what they do, but they're genuinely like good people.
Right.
And there's people that are on that list that I've spent many an hour consulting with personally on leadership and mentoring issues, you know, where I would seek their advice and seek their counsel. And so when I came out, you know, going into, you know, a group like this, it just seemed kind of like it was the right thing to do, because so many people that I had leaned on over the years for advice and for counsel and for their friendship had gravitated to CT Strategies. And so I do think that however way we try to convey that, either through the website or just through the way that we communicate with our external stakeholders, I think that really is important. The really important thing that distinguishes the core brand of CT Strategies from a lot of the other ones is, and it's hard to explain, but it's definitely there. So what are the types of things that you think that you've done either recently or that you're embarking on, which you think would are you most excited about or are you most proud of, either or?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question, and I'll use the previous topic to transition into it. So we've kind of, as we've grown up in the business, we've really matured to the point where we have three lines of business. The first one is what we call our business advisory services, which is consulting with companies that have products and services. We want to go back into CBP, but some other agencies as well. And we do that. We've done that, you know, for the 8.5 years that we've been doing this. The things and that is like our you know, regular, recurring, consistent work. And you know, when you match up with the right client and the right champion in the government, those are awesome projects to work on. The thing that we've been focusing on over the past couple of years with the help of AMA and our other staff is really building two other lines of business out. One is international capacity building work, and the other one is what we're calling our CTPAT Navigator. I'll start with the CTPAT Navigator. You know, we have, talking about our people, we have two former directors of the CTPAT program, as well as potentially a third whose name will remain out of the headlines until a later date. And as well as in our roster of affiliates, experiences with the Authorized Economic Operator program around the world. So we really thought that we could build a consulting line out of that service where we help companies do their CTPAT work, whether it's maintenance or getting ready for a first time validation. And that's starting to take off. And again, not to just keep giving credit to AMA, but she's taken a pretty expert team and really crafted a marketing strategy where we get our name out there. So that's a lot of fun, and that's growing, and we're doing a lot of good work there. And it wouldn't be possible if we didn't have the people to bring in, right? I mean, like that is a very confined, discrete subject matter area that requires certain people to be in. So we've been fortunate enough to be associated with people who are experts in that.
It's a sliver of expertise. It's right. A sliver. Right. And you know, as big as CEP is, and for as long as CEP has been around, you can count on one hand how many people have that kind of expertise.
Yeah, and it's such a good program that people stay in there for a long time. And so, you know, there's not a lot of people who have departed. I mean, the program's only, I shouldn't say only, but it's 20 years old, you know, at this point. And so you're right now starting to get some people who are departing the program.
Yeah, and they've had, what, four directors in those 20 years?
Yeah, four full-time, you know, permanent directors. Yeah, it's something.
Well, good luck on your number, on your acquisition.
Yeah. And so the other piece, the international one, I'll just spend a little bit of time on describing the context of how we arrived to that. Another example of trusting good people, no matter how much expertise they have. So we as a company have always done international capacity building work. And the way that usually works is we're a bunch of experts. People know us around the world. And when someone else gets a project, they call us up and say, hey, we want the American perspective, or you know, you have a certain expertise in risk or CTPAT or whatever, and we assign a subject matter expert to those programs, which is great. I mean, I've loved all the work that we've done with companies and countries around the world. That was always good work. And then I started toying with the idea a few years ago to say, you know, and it's a constant theme, like maybe we're not as dumb as we think we are, and like maybe we can do this ourselves. Like maybe we can do some work ourselves. And the first project we kicked around doing that was down in Panama. And we did, you know, through the embassy down there, we did a review of their NII systems, which is great work. And we realized one thing, that when we are in total control of the project, it goes so well for us, you know, in the management and the delivery of the product. And we control kind of the the outcome and live and die by what we are able to do. And we're like, yeah, let's do more of that. Well, easier said than done. On the international development side, you know, there is so much bureaucratic and administrative requirements in order to just be, you know, an American company that does work, whether it's through U.S. international development organizations like USAID or international and foreign agencies like GIZ. And so what we embarked on a couple of years ago, I remember we had another example of a really talented intern who joined us as a full-time employee, Maya Cotton, and she has since departed for Harvard. So I like to call ourselves now the training ground for Harvard.
Nice.
Which would make the people I grew up with laugh for sure. But we were talking, she was really interested in it. And I said, hey, run with it, see what we need to do. You know, how do we get ourselves in a position to get that work? And to her credit, she did. And she, you know, took advantage of the time in the pandemic where things started to slow down, couldn't move around a lot. And because we couldn't do that, it was an opportunity to build out the back end administrative structure that we need to even participate and to bid on these projects. So we took from really the beginning of 2020 through now, we're still kind of polishing up our back end support for that. But it's starting to bear fruit, and we're starting to get projects with GIZ. We're looking at projects with USTDA, and the one in GIZ, coming back to that theme of just good behavior, right? Like nice people like to work with nice people. I got an email about a month and a half ago from a gentleman, former Dutch customs official that I had worked with years ago on a project in Australia, and he is just one of the most genuinely great guys I have ever known. And he really came to me at a time in my life where maybe he thought I needed like a kind uncle or something. And he really took a shine to me and really just in our personal time, it was really helpful to me in a lot of things. And I hadn't heard from him in a while. And I see this email pop up and I'm just like, oh yeah, Pim, let's talk. And he says, hey, are you interested in bidding on a project in the Western Balkans? The Western Balkan countries have a new free trade agreement that in part of the provisions of that free trade agreement, they have to augment and get up to the same standard of their AEO program, for each country. And GIZ was looking at continuing some initial work that they had done with a broader, bigger approach to all these different countries, and hiring a company that would kind of be the clearinghouse for the subject matter experts. And so I thought, man, what perfect time. First of all, great guy, you know, so you never know when that kind of kindness is going to come back around. Second of all, what a perfect timing for us, right? We had just spent the past 2 years getting ourselves ready to be able to bid on something like that. And then the subject matter expertise, right? We're square in our wheelhouse, authorized economic operator, experts in, you know, the SAFE framework and you know, it was just like this culmination of like everything that we had done over the past few years. And so that was professionally satisfying for me to have that opportunity, which I think we can say publicly we've now won, and we're kicking off now.
Great.
And that, you know, just said to me, man, you know, we may not know exactly what we're doing, but some of the broader themes of what we're trying to do, you know, certainly if you stick with it, and it starts to pay off. And we won that one. We're also now, and this all happened within the course of a week, a little while ago. We won that one. We're also taking part in the helping to lead the study of the EU's AEO program. So that's going to kick off very quickly. And then we're also this week, as a matter of fact, kicking off the review of Ecuador's AEO program. And so, you know, in addition to the work we did with the CTPAT program last year, and it's just, you know, you kind of sit back and you don't want to really pat yourself on the back because I don't know that I did that with purpose, or anybody in this company did it with purpose. But if the broader themes, we certainly did. We knew we wanted to get into the international world. We knew we had to do stuff to prepare for that. And we knew we wanted to do it with that human approach that we bring. And I think, you know, sitting here now at the end of 2021, which has been the end of a crazy 2 years just in general, to be this happy and this kind of ready to take on the next challenge. We're set up and ready to do it.
So that's great. That's great. And I think that what I've seen and what I've experienced and the things that I've studied and read about, I think that that's also a consistent theme that folks kind of stick to their instincts, stick to what they know. They take chances, betting on themselves or betting on what they believe in, and it plays itself out. It doesn't obviously 100% of the time play itself that way, but I think if you look at anybody, that started their own business or started their own company or created their own widget, they just felt that something needed to be done in a certain way, and they committed the time and effort to do it. And then, many years later, it seemed like it was, it was foreshadowed all along. It all makes sense looking back on it. And I think when you look at someone like yourself and your partnership with Algina, the path that the two of you took to get to this point and the path that you're embarking on, I think it all makes sense. And that's one thing that I think is pretty consistent. We talk to folks that have gone through, different types of leadership positions or leadership experiences. None of them ever really had a playbook. No one ever had a map to follow. They just kind of followed they followed their instincts. They put the analysis in and they made an educated guess, for lack of a better term, as to what, direction to follow. On average, things worked out. There's probably, you could go back and you probably say, man, maybe they should have done this one a little differently. But you're batting, a few hundred. You're not necessarily batting 1,000, but in the grand scheme of things, everything seems to make sense because you've built a strong team, you've built a business around, a core mission that you believe in, and you've populated it with people that are of like mind.
Yeah.
Both personally and professionally. And just like you said, you're cherry picking some very, very unique talents from the US government, but also from around the world. If you look at the affiliate list, there's folks from all over the world on the team. And I think that this just kind of speaks to, the core brand, the core mission of what you guys are trying to continue to build. So as a closeout, do you have anything you'd like to share with our viewers and our listeners?
No, I think we covered it. I mean, I think the themes that we talked about, certainly for me personally, coming to this point in my life, in my professional life, in my personal life, like you said, there's no playbook. And I do some work. I teach an entrepreneur class, believe it or not. I'm now imparting my own ignorance on the youth in this city, to a junior high. Which, if you ever want just brutal honesty about where you are in this world, just talk to a seventh or eighth grader.
I have two in my house.
Yeah, I am sure there's
routine,
no short
routine. Honesty.
Ego is kept in check at that point. But one thing we always talk about in that class, and the kids are great, and they say, how do I do it? Right, I'm sitting here. I'm 12 years old. I want to own my own business. I want to do my own thing. And I just tell them all the time. I'm like, I couldn't tell you how I got here. Right, there's no line to follow in terms of, and I think historically we grow up in cultures where we believe that there is a checklist of actual things, right? Like, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do that. And sometimes that works out, right? That line takes you there. And I think the theme of what we talked about today is more, identify how you want to live your life, right? How you want to live personally and professionally, focusing on humanity, focusing on, doing things in the right way, surrounding yourself with good people, admitting your own ignorance at all turns. I think we do that probably better than anything else that we do. And then just kind of keep yourself open to cool stuff. I mean, growing up, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew when an opportunity presented itself to me that I said, this is some cool stuff. Like, I'm going to do this, and I don't know where it's going to take me, but I want to do this. And I've just taken that approach, throughout. And I think a bit of that is my own ability to stomach risk. But in other ways, it's just, matching up what makes you professionally and personally satisfied. And those two things don't have to be separate. And so creating that path for yourself or for a company or for anyone else is just really important to kind of raise that up a little bit and just understand, how what does my existence want to be? And now once you define that, the other stuff is pretty easy. And, you know, like at the end of the day, you get to come in, do podcasts like this, you hang out with cool people and, you know, hopefully give back a little bit and, you know, it's just a cool way to exist. And so, yeah, I appreciate this, Amma. I appreciate you putting these things together, Eric. You know, you're taking this on and doing your best Larry King impersonation as you ask.
Missing the suspenders though.
Yeah. But no, this is great. And it's fun, you know, aside from my ego, just to talk about myself for a full hour. It's fun to just sit and reflect and really just, especially at this time, end of the year, holiday time, it's good to just be thankful for all this. So really that's all I really wanted to end with, but I appreciate everything you guys put together for this.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and share your story with our viewers and our listeners. I think that's one of the things that I'm always very impressed with is just getting the story behind the story. You know, I gravitate to, you know, all sorts of, you know, documentaries and things of athletes and celebrities and things of that nature, because it's always fascinating to pick someone's brain to figure out how the path they took, you know, led them to where they are today. And I think the consistent theme is that more often than not, it wasn't methodical. It wasn't pre-planned. It was a lot of happenstance, a lot of opportunity, some risk analysis along the way. But I think that your commitment to yourself, to your family, to the things that you believe in, both professionally and personally, I think are demonstrable within CT Strategy. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I hope that our listeners and our viewers enjoyed it as much as I did. And I look forward to talking to you again, because I think that there's like 20 other topics we could spend another hour on. But I do know that we have to wrap it up now. So thanks for taking the time. And I wish you and your family a happy holiday season if I don't talk to you again. And thanks again.
Same to you. Thanks so much. All right.
Thank you for listening to this segment of CTS Unpacked. For more information about CT Strategies and our team members, visit our website at ctstrategies.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn to share your thoughts or any ideas you'd like to see in future segments. Stay in the loop by joining our newsletter, where we share the latest CTS updates. Until next time, this is CTS Unpacked.